damn it! My life has value!
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here's a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
The computer's in a box that was for a little bit smaller computer, so it bulges.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of You Have Tread on Me. Tonight's show is going to be a tar and feather with Gary Hunt, and we'll be starting that here in a moment. Want to remind everybody that starting tomorrow, we're going to be moving our servers over, so there might be some delays or problems with the stream and everything. So if there is a problem catching the new stream or anything, that's the reason why we're moving the servers. And from that point on, I'll be able to manage and maintain the server myself, or the website myself. We're going to start uploading all the past shows as well tomorrow. So a lot of those archives that are missing will get up there soon, as well as a lot of the changes we're going to have. First thing that's going to be going up is Joe Martino's book, and as everybody knows, if you're worried about the security of this country and, you know, its future and everything, I think that Joe Martino's book is a must-have. But I think it's probably one of the most important books ever written in this century. So you can get it from Amazon right now, or you can wait till tomorrow and you can start getting it from me. I'll have it a little bit cheaper than Amazon, and you'll be supporting me, which is always a bonus and a plus for me. So, with that being said, like I said, tomorrow we're going to have the big kickoff for the show, site again. It'll start getting maintained more often on a daily basis by me, so shows will start being uploaded on a regular basis, and the archives that are past due will be up there shortly. With that being said, welcome to the show, Gary. How you doing?
Just fine, Randy, and how do you like living back down on the south side of that border?
Man, I'm loving it out here. You know, I came here, I left, it was damn near wintertime still. I got here, it was summertime. And apparently we're not going to have a winter till November. So I'm loving it here, man. There is not a damn thing I miss about Canada, not one little bit.
Well, the way it's going, it might be later than November, but it's just temporary, it's this year only.
Hey, if I never see snow again, I'll be a happy camper. I swear, if I never see it again, I will be ecstatic. I lived with snow on the ground 9 months out of the year for the last 6 years. I'm done with that crap. And if anybody from Canada is listening, hey, I'm sorry. I don't miss your country, though. I'm glad to be home.
Well, let's see. We the People. You're one of We the People again.
I am one of the We the People now. I never met... One of We the People. I was always one of the We the People.
Yeah, but it seems the other day we had a conversation and you were wondering if you were We the People. And that,
well, yeah, because
means
you know, we
that...
had talked about that for a few minutes, had a little conversation, and you know, that's one of those things we're going to be talking about tonight. Who are We the People?
That's exactly it. Who are We the People? It's an interesting question, and how I came to write this, there are two reasons that I wrote it, really, and we'll get into the second reason a little later on in the show. But the first reason is some people had asked me to write. I've talked with a lot of people about what I've learned about the 14th Amendment over the years. And a lot of people asked me, can you write an article about it? I did. It was 71 pages long. That's with the appendix to it, which is some of the legislation and things, actually 50-some pages, I think. But then I was talking with a friend who helped me proofread it, and he did not get a picture of who We the People are, which is significant in terms of the 14th, but the 14th is jurisdiction, federal jurisdiction. It's a number of other things. It's the fact that how it was ratified. So it was a whole body of information, but there's a thread in there that is rather interesting, and really I didn't pick up on it until I was going back and redoing my homework. I mean, I've read Dred Scott probably two or three times in the past. It's an 1856 United States Supreme Court decision that basically said if your slave or your horse gets away, somebody catches your slave or horse, he has an obligation to return the slave or the horse to the original owner. And that was the context of it. Now, there was another aspect to Dred Scott that's rather interesting, and it's something that was enhanced in my mind as time went on, and that was Dred Scott had no standing to take this matter before the Supreme Court. He was the slave. Sanford right. was the slave owner. Sanford, however, when Dred Scott filed to go to the Supreme Court with this this matter, Sanford didn't say he has no right to go there. So since he got there and Sanford didn't object timely, or should I say set out jurisdiction timely, the court said, okay, it's here, we'll hear it. So they said Sanford has no right to be here, but since he's here, we're going to rule in this case. Now, when they talk about why Sanford couldn't be there, Justice Taney, the Chief Justice at the time, went into extensive detail, and the 14th Amendment article has probably about 70% of it. This shorter We the People article has just a small portion of it. And he defines, well, let me use his words. The words people of the United States and citizens are synonymous terms and mean the same thing. They both describe the political body who, according to our Republican institutions, form the sovereignty and who hold the power and conduct the government of government through their representatives. They are what we familiarly call the sovereign people, and every citizen is one of these people and a constituent member of this sovereignty. So he starts explaining with that statement. Now, a little further on, he goes into a little more detail on it when he says, it is true, every person in every class and description of persons who were at the time of the adoption of the Constitution recognized as citizens in the several states became also citizens of this new political body, but none other. It was formed by them and for them and their posterity, but for no one else. And the personal rights and privileges guaranteed to citizens of this new sovereignty were intended to embrace those only who were then members of the several state communities or who should afterwards by birthright or otherwise become members according to the provisions of the Constitution and the principles on which it was founded. Okay, now that's the confusing one. That's the one that threw Randy.
That can throw me. You know, I'm a kind of simple guy here, so you guys might have to explain that to me.
Well, you have to. When you read all of them, it becomes abundantly clear. But what it amounts to is, he says the rights and privileges guaranteed to citizens were intended to embrace only those who were then members of the several state communities, or who should afterwards, by birthright or otherwise, become members. Now, the Constitution has a provision for naturalization. So the ability to naturalize citizens had resided with the federal government all along. Therefore, they didn't need an amendment to change anything. Now, that naturalization provision would apply to any that were of the nature of those people, either by birthright or who came later, and in accordance with the Constitution and the principles on which it was founded. So the Constitution gave the right of naturalization. The principles on which it was founded was we the people, those that separated from England. I think that kind of makes it clear. I mean, it's kind of a confusing concept because we haven't looked at it in that manner before, but somewhere in 1867 there was an amendment to the Constitution that if what I'm saying is not true, they wouldn't have needed that amendment. And that amendment gave citizenship to the people who were subject to the jurisdiction of the federal government. So it gave them a new power of naturalization, basically, that they didn't have before. So we know who we the people are. Now, That's in part one of the article, We the People. In part five, I try and pull this together, and I've tried to look back. Now, I'm not trying to create anything that isn't there, so I tried to look back at what could be determined to be We the People in the eyes of the Founding Fathers. There were people from all over the world in the United States, not a whole lot of them like we have today, but there were people from all over. So there are three possibilities that I've come up with. One is what is commonly referred to white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And they would be people that weren't Catholic or Jewish in faith, but white Anglo-Saxon or European descent. Now, Anglo-Saxon actually implies England rather heavily. And we know it wasn't restricted to that because we had Italians, Germans, Frenchmen, Czechoslovakians, Danish, Dutch, people from all over Europe. Now, the second possibility then would be people of European descent, people from Europe. And the third one is what's called Indo-European languages. It was a term that was coined in 1647, so it predates the Constitution. But generally, that is a language groups that goes down into the Balkan region, includes some of the Mediterranean countries. But for the most part, they were Caucasian or primarily Caucasian by their makeup. So okay. Those are the three possibilities that could have been. So somewhere within that mix is what the Founding Fathers perceived as the people that created this government. Now he goes on to talk about the Declaration of the Independence with regard to this, and I'll read that quote. In the opinion of the court, the legislation and histories of the times and the language used in the Declaration of Independence show that neither the class of persons who had been imported as slaves nor their descendants, whether they had become free or not, were then acknowledged as a part of the people, nor intended to be included in the general words in that memorable instrument. So clearly he sees that there was an exclusion within the Declaration of Independence. He addresses one in particular, and that's the one that's before the court right now, being an ex-slave. And even though Crispus Attucks was shot to death in the Boston Massacre, it did not make him one of We the People, and that issue was not contested until the 860s. So that's foundation. Next, we move on to the 14th Amendment itself. And I didn't find myself.
Did you lose yourself?
I lose myself all the time. Let me look around. I think I can find me.
We'll send out a search and rescue party for you.
The 14th Amendment says, all persons born and naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. Well, they were given privileges and immunities. They weren't given rights. Now, Taney talked about rights that existed to We the People, but here we've got very specific. We're talking about giving privileges and immunities, and as I said, if the government already had the right to naturalize these people because they were We the People, they could have naturalized them. But when they naturalized them, they didn't give them rights. They only gave them privileges and immunities. So that makes a distinctly different sort of person. And, it's not my words. This is the fact of history. So we have an understanding that, here's another quote in part two. It poisons the blessings of liberty itself, and it will be of little avail to the people that the laws are made by men of their own choice if the laws be so voluminous that they cannot be read, or so incoherent that they cannot be understood. If they be repealed or revised before they are promulgated or undergo such incessant changes that no man who knows what the law is today can guess what it be will be tomorrow. Law is defined to be a rule of action, and how can that be a rule which is little known and less fixed? Now, there's no doubt that by the 14th Amendment, this was fixed. Who we the people were, the fact that the naturalization of slaves or ex-slaves or anybody else that was not part of we the people was not a right or a power given to the federal government, because if it was, they wouldn't have had to propose and ratify the 14th Amendment. So we've got a very firm case now that what we're doing is creating a different class of people that have only rights and immunities. So then we go, now the question, and somebody pointed out in a conversation on one of the lists I'm on, he says, well, the Constitution doesn't grant rights. Well, no, it doesn't. The rights are inherent to we the people. The Declaration of Independence makes it abundantly clear that the rights are given by God. Or by, well, let's see, let's find that one. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we're endowed by our Creator with those rights. Now, Taney did point out that if anybody in that period, 1787 to 1789, had said that we're going to give rights to black people, the whole world would have turned against them, because that was not an accepted concept at the time. So that's not an abnormal situation, but there was concern in the founders that most of the founders were supportive of manumission, which was the slow dissolving of slavery and conversion to some authority to exist within the country under the Constitution. So we get to a case that Minor versus Happersett, an 1874 case. So we're 7 years after the 14th Amendment. And the question here deals specifically with rights. The question is, if rights exist, can the government grant rights? And Happersett set forth a number of queries to the court, and the court said, well, there's only one thing that we have to decide. Let's see, looking at the Constitution itself, we find that it was ordained and established by the people of the United States. That's from the preamble. And then going further back, we find these were the people of the several states that had before dissolved the political bonds which connected them with Great Britain and assumed a separate and equal station among the powers of the earth. Now, that's the Declaration of Independence. And that had, by Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, in which they took the name the United States of America, entered into a firm league of friendship with each other for their common defense, the security of their liberties and their mutual general welfare, binding themselves to assist each other against all force offered to or attack made upon them or any of them on account of religion, sovereignty, trade, or any other pretense whatsoever. And that's from the Articles of Confederation. Whoever, then, was one of the people of either of these states when the Constitution of the United States was adopted became ipso facto a citizen, a member of the nation created by its adoption. He was one of the persons associating together to form the nation and was consequently one of its original citizens. As to this, there has never been a doubt. Disputes have arisen as to whether or not certain persons or certain classes of persons were part of the people at the time, but never as to their citizenship if they were. So that was inclusive of that group. He made it very clear that's inclusive of that group. Now, as it said, we said earlier in Taney, that goes down to anybody brought in under the Constitution under that original authority. So the issue here was, I got to find that. He's got an interesting list in the case, and this kind of gets off the subject a little bit, but I'm going to read a quote from the case, and then I'm going to go and read you something that I find rather interesting, because what's happened in this country, the federal government, by the 15th Amendment, which was a couple of years after the 14th Amendment, granted the right of suffrage to those citizens of the United States, or anybody regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So what they did is that prior to that, the states had the right to decide who could and could not vote.
Right.
After that, the federal government then assumed the authority to, by constitutional amendment, make determination. Now, we've seen subsequent changes to that. Women's right to vote was eventually federal, even though states were slowly coming online with that. The 18-year-old right to vote, which I think was during the Vietnam War, wasn't it, when they wanted these guys to feel, if you're going to get killed for the country, the least we can do is let you vote. So the federal government assumed an authority or that really they never had. They created it by duping the states into ratifying these warm and fuzzy amendments. But here's what they said in Happersett. It is clear, therefore, we think that the Constitution has not added the right of suffrage to the privileges and immunities of citizens as they existed at the time it was adopted. This makes it proper to inquire whether suffrage was coextensive with the citizenship of the states at the time of its adoption. If it was, then it may with force be argued that suffrage was one of the rights which belonged to citizens, in the enjoyment of which every citizen must be protected. But if not, if it was not, the contrary may with propriety be assumed. Now, then he goes on and he says, each state determined for itself who should have that power. Thus, in New Hampshire, every male inhabitant of each town and parish with town privileges and places unincorporated in the state of 21 years of age and upwards, excepting paupers and persons excused from paying taxes at their own request, were its voters. In Massachusetts, every male inhabitant of 21 years of age and upwards, having a freehold estate within the Commonwealth of the annual income of £3, or any estate of that the value of £60, in Rhode Island, such as are admitted free of the company and society of the colony, which means that they're not free of the company and society, which the company was the charter and the society. If they were indentured servants, they could not vote. In Connecticut, such person as had maturity in years, quiet and peaceable behavior, a civil conversation, and 40 shillings freehold or £40 personal estate, if so certified by the selectman. In New York, every male inhabitant of full age who shall have personally resided within one of the counties of the state for 6 months immediately preceding the day of election, if during the time aforesaid he shall have been a freeholder possessing a freehold of the value of £20 within the county, or have rented a tenement therein of the yearly value of 40 shillings and been rated and actually paid taxes to the state. In New Jersey, all inhabitants of full age who are worth £50 proclamation money, clear estate in the same, and have resided in the county in which they claim a vote for 12 months immediately preceding the election. In Pennsylvania, every freeman of the age of 21 years, having resided in the state 2 years next before the election, and within that time period, paid a state or county tax, which shall have been assessed at least 6 months before the election. In Delaware and Virginia, as exercised by law at present. Now, that's what he said in the case, and I'm not sure what that means. In Maryland, all freemen above 21 years of age having a freehold of 50 acres of land in the county in which they offered to vote and residing therein, and all freemen having property in the state above the value of £30 current money and having resided in the county in which they offered to vote one whole year next preceding the election. in North Carolina for senators, all freemen of the age of 21 years who have been inhabitants of one county within the state 12 months immediately preceding the day of election and possessed of a freehold within the same county of 50 acres of land for 6 months next before and at the day of election. And for members of the House of Commons, all freemen of the age of 21 years who have been inhabitants in one county within the state 12 months immediately preceding the day of any election and shall have paid public taxes. In South Carolina, every free white man of the age of 21 years being a citizen of the state and having resided therein 2 years previous to the day of election and who hath a freehold of 50 acres of land or a town lot of which he hath been legally seized and is possessed at least 6 months before such election, or if not having such freehold or town lot, hath been a resident within the election district in which he offers to give his vote 6 months before said election, and hath paid a tax preceding the preceding year of 3 shillings sterling towards the support of the government. And in Georgia, such citizens and inhabitants of the state as shall have attained to the age of 21 years and shall have paid tax for the year next preceding the election and shall have resided 6 months within the county. Okay, that's the list that was included in the state to show that the state had the authority then to decide who could vote. Now, the federal government allows whoever is qualified to vote for the highest house in the state can vote in the presidential elections for the Electoral College. Now, did you notice anything in that list, any common element throughout all that thing? Did you catch it, Randy?
Yeah, they all had to be freeholders and free men.
Or at least pay taxes.
They all had property, or pay taxes and property holders.
So if they were destitute or on the public dole or living off of charity, they could not vote.
They could not vote.
So then the government comes along and says, oh, these people who were slaves, and obviously they don't have a freehold, they can vote. They've undermined the entire concept and taken away from we the people the authority to determine the outcome of the elections, whether in the state or on the federal level, and began passing it on to people who eventually become the major beneficiaries of any giveaway program promulgated by that government. But the right to vote was granted by the federal government, and it may seem strange, but the right was granted. So obviously, if they could, they could not grant a right to people that held it already. So what they did is they granted a right to people who had no rights before. They only had privileges and immunity. So they made the first singular exception to privileges and immunities by granting the right to vote and mandating it to the states. Now that whole matter. Now we've got two classes of citizen. Then we've got citizens of the United States, which was used in the Constitution, but as of the 14th Amendment, the definition of that word changed, at least for those that came later. What it did is it nullified the use of that term in the previous document, the Constitution, and it reverts it back to we the people, because you can't redefine what is by a subsequent change in definition. You can't make a tree a flower by saying, okay, flower is spelled T-R-E-E now, nor can you make what was used in the Constitution as citizen of the United States, which was, in context, was a citizen of one of the states of the United States, since there was no real federal citizenship until the 14th Amendment. So, citizen of the United States in the Constitution applies to a citizen of one of the United States. But okay, also has to be somebody that is otherwise qualified, which Taney went into more detail that if the state made a Negro a citizen, he still would not have the rights. And that was in 1856. So then after, we've got a new term, citizen of the United States, which is verbicide. It's using an old term, but creating a new class of people. Now, people challenge that there can't be two types of citizen in this country, but there's a case in 1908 called Twining versus State of New Jersey. Albert Twining and David Cornell were denied due process according to the 14th Amendment. But they stated that they were New Jersey citizens. So what happened is the court said, well, you're New Jersey citizens, and the jurisdiction for your case is not the 14th Amendment, it's the state law. And the state law isn't grossly in violation of the 14th Amendment. Therefore, you're subject to state law. You're not subject to the protections afforded by the 14th Amendment because they were state citizens. And as they said in the case, if the right here asserted is not a federal right, that is the end of the case. And it was because they were state citizens. He went on to point out some obvious things regarding it, but he said you're under one jurisdiction or the other. You can't be under both. Here's what he said. The 14th Amendment withdrew from the state powers theretofore enjoyed by them to an extent not yet fully ascertained, or rather, to speak more accurately, limited those powers and restrained their exercise. There is no doubt of the duty of this court to enforce the limitations and restraints whenever they exist, and there has been no hesitation in the performance of that duty. But whenever a new limitation or restriction is declared, it is a matter of grave importance, since to that extent it diminishes the authority of the state so necessary for the perpetuity of our dual form of government and changes its relation to its people and the Union. The defendant contend in the first place that their exemption from self-incrimination is one of the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States which the 14th Amendment forbids by the states to abridge. It is not argued that the defendants were protected by that part of the Fifth Amendment, which provides that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, for it is recognized by counsel that by a long line of decisions, the first 10 amendments are not operative on the states. So had they argued under the Fifth Amendment of self-incrimination, those rights, they might have prevailed, but instead they were argued under the 14th Amendment due process and were not. So Twining established that there are two classes of citizen, and they existed in 1908 in this country. Now, I've not seen a Supreme Court decision that's changed that. I mean, I'm sorry, I have not seen an amendment to the Constitution that's changed that. What has happened, though, is for the most part, we have been caught up in something that is believing something to be true that is not true. And that is, if you're charged with federal crime, you assume that the federal government has jurisdiction over you and can take you to court. Now, that wasn't true in the Twining case. The federal government washed their hands of it. But let's go back to Dred Scott. Nobody challenged, Sanford didn't and Dred Scott didn't, challenged the jurisdiction of the court in that matter. So the court said, well, you're here. We'll hear the case. Now, I've written a couple articles about this. One of them has to do with habeas corpus. The article is called What If I'm Arrested? And it had to do with me challenging the jurisdiction of a traffic court. I didn't, you know, for years in the Patriot community, for almost 30 years now, I've said people say you have to go in and you have to assert your authority to the court. And that's when the court says the Constitution doesn't apply here. Well, they're probably right, because if you accept that, then you are in that administrative court. However, what I did in the with the habeas corpus is I can't find the injured party. I didn't say I'm not here to address your traffic laws or anything like that. I said I can't find an injured party. I need this court to bring forward the injured party with an affidavit as to the nature of injury. If this is civil rather than criminal, I need the injured party to bring the original contract, which I'm alleged to be party to and in violation of. So I had just assumed that I was in a common law court, not a statutory or administrative agency court. And within 18 seconds, the judge had me out of the room. He got the state to null prosecute a case that they'd already, that means don't prosecute a case that they had already set jury trial date for. And he told me to get out of his courtroom. I didn't tell him what the law was. That's always a mistake, because the judge has the authority to do all kinds of things, you including and not limited to contempt of court and time in jail. So I didn't assert my right. I just assumed that I had my right and explained that I can't find what I need to fulfill that right, the injured party. And that was a challenge of jurisdiction, but it was done in an indirect way. I did not tell the judge what the law was, because, like I say, that's the biggest mistake you can make, because he'll violate the law to get back at you for telling him his job. And you probably would too if you were in a position of power like he is. I wrote an article, Ashwander versus TVA, which goes into what Justice Brandeis told us in 1937 of the position the court has adopted in matters before the Supreme Court of the United States. And there are seven of them, and among them is the last thing we're going to do is rule on the constitutionality of a matter before this court, and only if we can find no other way to avoid ruling on the constitutionality. And he goes on to list a couple of other means of disposing, like if somebody seeks the benefit of an administrative agency, they're bound by the rules of the agency. If somebody doesn't have standing, if they have not been harmed by the statute or the law. So there are all these things that obstacles that have been put in place to avoid ruling on the constitutionality, and so we've been really duped into not defending our rights, but not by asserting them, but by assuming that they exist. And the whole idea for me writing the what I have about the 14th Amendment and the two classes of citizenship has to do with that very thing. We cannot assert it, but we need to understand what we are, who we are, how we are, why we are, and where we are, if we're going to achieve the goal that we're seeking, which is restoration of constitutional government. That knowledge is fundamental. If we're truly patriots and don't have that knowledge, we don't know what we're fighting for. We have to know what the goal is. Some will say it's freedom. Some will say it's liberty. Define those words. Well, they've been defined through history, and I've just read you some of the aspects of definition, where the states had the right to make determination. That's been taken away. Where freeholders were the only ones that selected who was going to run the government. It's just like a corporation. If I work for the corporation, I don't get to vote on, you know, they give me a paycheck. I don't get to vote on the who the officers are going to be. It's the shareholders that are vested in that have the right to vote. And don't mistake what I just said. I did not say the United States is a corporation. I don't believe that line. And I'll be glad to take on anybody that does and show them the error of their ways. However, but using that as an analogy, you don't just let anybody come in and vote. But the Supreme Court, but the Congress of the United States in 1867 opened the door to allowing them making the determination. And when they did, they took away the right of each of those then 27 states, the right for them to determine how their legislatures were selected. They took away the sovereign right of the states that was given them by the, or protected in the Constitution, and you know, took it upon themselves to undermine it.
Well, you know what's interesting, Gary, is that when we talk, you know, when we look back at these things that you spoke about, or spoken about who we the people were, who had the right to vote, you know, we forget that a lot. You know, our founding fathers took a long look at every form of government that had ever existed in known history. And when we look back at one of the contributors to our form of government, which was the Republic of Rome. Throughout Rome, Rome was not just the Roman city, it was the area surrounding Rome as well as many of the Italian states. Now, those Italian states did not have the people in those Italian states did not have citizenship, but they were part of Rome. Now, we're talking before the big expansion into Turkey and every place else, we're still talking about the Italian states. Now, citizenship was something that was greatly coveted by these Italian states, yet they did not get citizenship. And the right to vote was strictly regulated. You had to be a free individual. You must be a landholder. You had to be a member of the legions or a member of the fighting army. In other words, you must have something at stake within this country or within our government, within our state, in order to be able to vote. And that's the one thing that I saw as you read through the various states and their requirements for the right to vote was that those individuals had something at stake.
They were the shareholders by their investment in the country. They helped to build the country, not to tear it down. And we've gone the other way now and given it to the people that are more than willing to tear it down. Now, point comes here, you know, when I some of the people that reviewed this, you know, people are going to think you're a racist. Now, please don't think that. It's Justice Taney, the Supreme Court, even the people that wrote the 14th Amendment are the ones that put these words down. They're the ones that decided who we the people are. They decided not to change that. They didn't repeal anything in the Constitution when they wrote the 14th Amendment. They granted only privileges and immunities. And now there was another point in there, and that one has to do with federal jurisdiction. And it's not in the We the People article, but in 1825, the Congress enacted a law to protect government property on government land. And it's in the 14th Amendment article, but it was a statute passed by Congress, and it says that on any land ceded by the state to the federal government where they've also ceded jurisdiction, we will enforce these laws against people who damage government-owned property. Now, they realized then that if land wasn't ceded, and that's not just sold, that means the state has to say, okay, federal government, you can have it, whether they paid for it or not, it transfers a degree of ownership, but without ceding jurisdiction, still only the state laws apply. So their jurisdiction was very limited in 1825, and there's nothing in the Constitution, no amendment, that extended that jurisdiction beyond that, except by virtue of having the recognition that people are subject to jurisdiction like Dred Scott, and Sanford didn't object. So when you don't object, you end up stuck there. But the reason for this, now, this goes in two directions. I'm going to go with the underlying one first. There's another set of articles following this that is going to be dealing with factions. And we need to know, we need to understand what factions are. They're groups that form for a purpose. They don't have to be, you know, we meet every Sunday and all this stuff, but they have common elements. In fact, Randy, talk for a minute. Let me find my definitions of faction.
I know that was something that I brought up to you, was, you know, that comment that you made about, you know, this is sounding kind of racist and so forth. You know, that was one of the comments that when I first started reading the your articles on on who we the people are. And I'd heard that many times in the past, you know, especially in the 90s, with, you know, coming from the Aryan Brotherhood, the, you know, white supremacist, you know, white separatists, white supremacist groups, things like that. You know, who we the people were, and they always claimed that it was white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and that was it. So that was my first question to you. You know, this sounds very familiar. And so who are we the people? And, you know, my question to you came about was, you know, about that, you know, what about me? I'm one of, you know, I had always thought I was one of we the people, but I hadn't finished reading all the way down, or I had missed that little line where it talked about, you know, the various Europeans that were in there.
Yeah, and under the Constitution and its principles.
Exactly. So, you know, and I had forgotten about, you know, I hadn't gotten down to that part yet, but that was one of the first questions I had was, well, you know, what the hell? You know, from what I'm saying so far, based upon one of the explanations of who we the people were, which was white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, which, you know, was coming from that, you know, that I heard back from the Metzgers and so forth back in the 90s. You know, that was one of the questions that was raised is, well, what about me? You know, I'm of Spanish descent. My family was not here during the founding of it. My family was, we were dons in, you know, in what was known as Mexico at the time, up in the New Mexico region. But you were right, though. You know, from there, though, the state, you know, the federal government always had the ability to grant naturalization and citizenship to people that were coming in at the time as well. It wasn't just to the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, as you mentioned. There was Italians, there was Germans, there was Dutch, there was French, there was Greek. There was a lot of different people here.
But they were the only ones that were could be accepted under that naturalization provision of the Constitution. Those from the, they, you know, in my mind, you know, I get this picture of white Europeans, which may sound racist, but they were white Europeans. Anyway, let's go on to factions, and this is where something very important comes into play. But a faction, according to Webster's 1828, is a party in a political society combined or acting in union in opposition to the prince, government, or state, usually applied to a minority, but it may be applied to a majority. Sometimes a state is divided into factions nearly equal. Or a group of people forming a cohesive, usually contentious minority within a larger group. So we've got a real strong one, which would be kind of the British, the loyal opposition is a faction. And the other one, a group of persons forming a cohesive, usually contentious minority within a larger group. Now, that's more subtle. And to join that group, you don't really have to sign up anywhere or go to meetings. All you have to do is associate with it. So, and there are a lot of factions in this country, and perhaps we haven't thought about it, but I'm going to list a few. There's the Mexican-Americans, there's the Muslims, there's the African-Americans, there's the Chinese-Americans, the Japanese-Americans, Korean-Americans, Vietnamese-Americans. Oh, let's go a little further. There's the queers, and they're a faction too. They, by association, have attempted to achieve political power. But we have all these factions in this country, and in well, one of my first articles in my comeback to the Patriot community about 3 years ago is called Divide and Conquer. Now, divide and conquer is the fact that we're going in 1,000 directions. We're 911 Truth, birthers, the United States Corporation, in the Federal Reserve, all these, this broad spectrum. And, you know, if we got 40, 50,000 people in each of those groups, if we got them all together, we'd have millions of people working on the same course. But they are factions as well. What we need to do, though, if we are going to prevail, is make a determination what the principal faction in this country is. When I say principal faction, it's the majority. And it should forever, by the Constitution and what I've just told you about who we the people are, that principal faction should be we the people and those who assimilate into that society and support that society and its purpose. So if a Negro, an American Negro, is assimilated into society, wants to be an American, not an African American, but wants to be an American, and supports the fact that the goal of this country was for white European culture and heritage. Another article I wrote, Nations, has to do with that. They are part of that principal faction, and I'm going to call it the principal faction because by the Constitution, that principal faction was for the purpose of these people. Anybody that supports that faction that is legally here, whether they are we the people, a citizen of a state or a proper we the people, or a citizen of the United States and have obtained privileges and immunities and certain rights granted by amendments, that adhere to those principles is the principal faction. We've got to get rid of these other factions. We've got to understand that that principal faction is an extremely powerful force. If we gather around that faction and its ideals and pursue those. To do that, though, we've got to understand, again, just like understanding who you are, if you are we the people and where you fit in the scheme, or if you're just a citizen of the, I don't want to say just a citizen of the United States, if you're a citizen of the United States and adhere to the principles of this country, you are of that principal faction. You've got to lay the other factions aside. Somebody brought up a question to me a couple weeks ago. He says, what about Christian militia? If I'm not a Christian, can I join it? Well, you know, a Christian militia can't be a militia. It's factionalized itself out of the principal element because there's nothing in the Constitution that says you have to be a Christian to be in the militia. The militia is exactly the right of everybody. Now, is it right to have two militias in one place because some guys aren't Christian and some are? No, it's not going to work that way. The principal element is we the people. Drop that Christian from your militia. It does not belong there. There is no lawful justification for you factionalizing that militia and saying we're not allowing people that are not Christians in this militia. You have violated the intention of the Constitution by asserting that you have the authority to do that.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, if you read the Constitution, it says every able-bodied male. It does not segregate for this militia for these groups, this militia for this group, this militia for that group. It says of every male body, of every male body, or every able-bodied male.
Male or persons, depending on the state.
Or persons, depending on the state, yes.
Now, since they have to subordinate to civil authority and you can't have two governments operating side by side, the presumption has to be that you're going to have a Christian Committee of Safety and a non-Christian Committee of Safety. Now, who runs the town? The Christian Committee of Safety, the non-Christian Committee of Safety, the Christian militia, or the non-Christian militia? We've got a problem here, and we're going to be fighting among ourselves over the fact that if I'm not a Christian, I can't be in the militia. If I'm a Christian, I can't be in your militia. And we're facing the wrong way. We're facing each other with rifles drawn rather than facing the enemy with rifles drawn. Now, the same thing applies, and I'm going to say it. I'm going to stick my neck out right here. The same thing applies to people who claim to be members of the National Socialist Movement. If they're adherents to the Constitution, they are a Christian militia type faction who want to exclude others or not. And if they don't exclude others, they have as much right to be a part of that principal element as we do, so long as they don't break the law. Now, in a conversation with some people the other day, we were going over this very subject. Well, what if they're in the militia? Now, World War II, all the way up through World War II, Negro units and white units were separated. In fact, in World War II, for the most part, Negroes were servants. They waited on officers. They loaded ships at Hunters Point in San Francisco Bay. They did menial work. They didn't do fighting, but few occasions. But one of the most honored aviation units was the Tuskegee Airmen. I think it's 43rd Fighter Squadron or something like that. So right. They were allowed to fight, but there was separation. And that separation was being dissolved by force, by edict of law. I think people were fairly comfortable with it then, especially the airmen and those Negroes that were allowed to fight. There were, I think, a Japanese unit in World War II in Italy that fought, got a lot of awards too. But they fought as a unit. They wanted to be a unit. Now, each of these had white officers, but that separation was there. Now, there's nothing wrong with that separation. So if you've got a militia, and there's a militia there and a militia there, and you come together, if there's within that militia command, they want separation between the units, they can make squads, companies, or anything else separate the way they choose. But you can't deny those that adhere at the principal element from participation because of anything else. You have to recognize that principal element is the most important aspect of it. And we have to live by that. Factions. We got to get rid of these smaller factions. If anything, they can be talking points amongst us, not causes of dissension amongst us. If we can't work together, we will fail.
You know, you bring up a great point there. And in fact, you know, if we look back at the whole the essay that you wrote on Divide and Conquer, you know, that's one of those that's one of those prime examples that points that your essay points directly to. We have so many divisions within our country, so many divisive elements within our country that we are no longer we the people, and that's something that we need to get back to. We the people under a common banner, under one banner. You know, and unfortunately, though, we seem to keep ourselves divided by Christian labels or agnostic labels or, you know, Southern Baptist labels. You name it, there's a label for it. There's 10 million labels out there, but, all we need is one label. We the people. You know, that's part of the problem with our country is we have gotten away from the concept of we the people. You know, instead we put ourselves in these little boxes, segregating ourselves from we the people, separating ourselves and creating more division amongst ourselves, even amongst those who say that they're upon a common purpose and a common goal with the rest of us, you know, the restoration of our constitutional government. And yet they want to segregate themselves from the rest of their people, you know, from the rest of the team, if you will. We're all on the same team, as Fox often tells me, same team.
There's there's a way that they've achieved that too, and that is one is creating factions legislatively. For example, they talk about how secure the Mexican borders in, but we've got 12 or 13 million illegal aliens in this country. That's a faction. And if that faction begins joining with the Muslim faction, the Chinese faction, the Korean faction, eventually they will have a force that is perhaps stronger and greater, especially when you consider a lot of we the people being subject to political correctness, believe that they don't believe in the principal faction element, that they might abandon the principal faction and join this warm and fuzzy coalition being formed of all these other factions. And if they succeeded, they would actually be doing away with the Constitution. But the what's created the groundwork, the playing field that we have responded to, is political correctness. You used to be able to tell Polish jokes, Negro jokes, wish I had a watermelon. When I was a kid, all these jokes flew around, and everybody laughed at them. Polish jokes are the best, I think. And my first wife and three of my is Polish, and three of my children are half Polish. But we tell Polish jokes when we're together sometimes. But political correctness has made us afraid to say things. I was on a Patriot site, a well-known Patriot site, and I was in the, having a discussion in one of the state groups, and I was asked to leave. Why was I asked to leave? Because I called a queer. If I can't call a queer a gay person, wait a minute, that's political correctness. They're queers. So that's how much has permeated our community. We see it all the time. We see it, we're a Christian militia. No, we won't allow National Socialists in. National Socialists, the one I've met over the years, and I just sent Randy an article earlier, these guys are adhering to the principal element, or principal faction. They are adhering to it. They have gotten defensive, they've gathered in a circle, and they've gotten a lousy banner to stand under. It's called the swastika. But they found a group that they could stand back to back with and face the world, the political correct world, and say, we don't like what's happening in this country. So if that's their refuge, or if the refuge is with the Bible in hand, it doesn't matter if your back is going to be against the back of other people, they have to be of the principal element. So anybody that believes in the principal faction and is willing to put their back against that faction to defend it needs to be willing to stand side by side by any other person who's willing to put his back to that principal faction and defend it. We've got to get rid of this petty bullshit that separates us. Now, Divide and Conquer was written about organizations trying to do things legislatively. But I think we're getting past the point that matters anymore, and that will be the next conversation in just a few minutes. The time is coming that we have to decide that mentally, socially, and politically, we understand which faction is important above all others. That doesn't mean that you have to abandon the aspects of Christianity or any other aspect. However, so long as it fits properly under the Constitution prior to 1861, how's that? Fits under the Constitution prior to 1861. That adherence has to be there. Now, we have to accept that citizens of the United States do exist. So let's say 1867, because they are citizens of the United States. By an amendment, whether properly ratified or not, it's become a way of life. And as long as their adherence to the principal faction, their adherence to the concept of the Constitution, they are American Negroes, not African Americans. They are elements of that principal faction. Maybe they're secondary citizens because that's the way it is, because the primary faction is the objective. Now, every nation has to have a common heritage and a common culture. You let a foreign heritage or a foreign culture or a foreign heritage and culture come in and begin to affect the flow of that, you've changed the course. that was set out by the founding fathers 220 years ago. And the Constitution is not a suicide document, therefore it has to maintain its course properly. Not the way Congress has done it since 1867. But it has to maintain that proper course. If the divinely inspired United States of America is to survive in the world of today. A lot of changes have to be made, but most important, we need to understand what faction is important and all the others are secondary and cannot be anything that is damaging to that principal faction. Now, why am I talking about these things and at the risk of having my head on the block being supporting NSM, which I'm not? I'm supporting the right of individuals to speak out, supporting the concept that Negroes are lesser citizens than the white citizens, which makes me subject to being called a racist. I'm not. The reason I'm bringing this out now is most of the people that know me know that I'm a student of history. And my wife, every Christmas and every year on my birthday, buys me history books. Now I'm getting them on Kindle as well. And I've got a decent library behind me. History's fascinating, and there's a lot of sayings about if we don't learn from history, we'll be doomed to repeat it. When I run out of books on the American Revolution, then I venture into... I haven't gone into the War of 1812 that much yet. It's kind of a perplexing war, and it's not really clear. There are some aspects around it rather interesting because they recognized in the declaration of the War of 1812, for example, that the British government was trying to infiltrate our government and undermine our Constitution. But Civil War, World War One, World War Two, Korean War, Vietnam, Russian Revolution, French Revolution. What's happening, what a lot of people refer to as Arab Spring, Yemen, Syria, Egypt, and Lebanon. In all these elements in history, what happens is a number of things occur and they begin gelling into something that will be a spark. It will be a focal point of change. It'll develop into something, anticipated or not, that will be earth-changing, or at least country-changing. And I think, with all my reading, now, there's a couple articles I wrote, C3CM, which has to do with a government program to identify people within a country and classify them as how much a threat they are to the existing government, or supportive of the existing government, depending on which side the government wants to take. Informants Amongst Us, which talks about a plea agreement. Now, there's a lot more means beyond Informants Amongst Us by which people can be induced into changing sides, giving up their integrity. And, for example, if I owned a child daycare center or operated a daycare center and my wife and I did, and I was old and too old to go out and get a job and work, but was making a decent living off of this. And Child Protective Services, probably second only to IRS as far as feared by people in this country. And if they came in and said, we got questions about reissuing your license because of your political activities, I might be willing to say, give in a little, give up my principles and say, well, I got to have this daycare center or I won't be able to feed my family. And for that reason, then I might start changing it. Anyway, I don't want to go into detail on that. Some of you are aware of it, but it's a means of getting people to compromise themselves and perhaps innocently saying, yeah, I can do a few things. Well, I guess we'll go a little farther on that. If I wanted to, back in the 90s, I'm personally aware of two instances where people were hidden from the government. I was involved directly in one. The other one I found out about when I spent time in Washington and Idaho. The first one that I'm aware of was actually the first of the two, and it happened in early February 1993 when there was a knock on my office door, and a guy was named Peter Chernoff was there, and he had fled California with his girlfriend and his son to keep her away from what he felt would be satanic ritual abuse. Can't think of that military officer's name right now that who was involved in some of the daycares that the boy's mother wanted to put him in. So we hit him until he was ready to turn himself in from the FBI. They came to my office, but he'd moved out of my office by then and gone into one of the security team members' house. And so we managed to hide him. The other one was Paul Fada. He was a Davidian. He was out of town when the raid took place. From what I understand, he actually went back to Waco. Government didn't realize it. He found out that they were going to arrest him, so he left Waco, went up to the Northwest, and was hidden, passed around from Washington into Idaho, and kept away from the FBI until he chose to turn himself in, which when he did, he made sure attorneys were there and he wouldn't be shot when he got off the plane or anything. Those kind of underground railroads, and they kind of grew because they were there. Now, I'm going to talk specifically about something, and some of you know what I'm talking about. There's a web page that says Underground Railroad. Sign up here. Now, I talked to one of the members of that site, one of the administrators of that site, and he agreed with me that if you're going to advertise and put your name, address, phone number, and what you're willing to do for the Underground Railroad online, rather than that, why don't we just make big signs for these people that says, if a fleeing patriot, or don't look for fleeing patriots here. It's advertising. Now, what you've done is you've set a net out. If the government watches all these people that are willing to be Underground Railroad, just surveils them from across the street like they did the Davidians, and they see somebody fleeing, like Randy Mack is fleeing, and he goes into this undercover house, and they just wait until he leaves the house, and then they go grab him and leave the house open to draw in other people like a spider web. So it's stupid to have something like Underground Railroad. In fact, even to talk on the internet is of, I will hide people, you know, you get them, here's my address and all that. To do that on the internet is giving up the farm. You have just removed yourself from working there. But see, that kind of activity seems to be getting more and more aggressive on a few sites on the internet now. There are some other things that are happening. We see these flash mobs. Now, what are flash mobs? This is where the police turn their backs. There was one in Milwaukee last week where one of the factions, not the principal faction, went into a convenience store, and they're walking out with shelves loaded with things in the store, and they abused a few of the white people. Hey, I sound like the press now. I didn't say they were black, but they abused some white people, so you can discern from that they were a black flash mob, and they went and just ripped this store off. And it's happening all over the country. They're called flash mobs. And the police, for the most part, have had to turn their back on them, whether for political reasons or not, I'm not sure. Now, in the Milwaukee case, they're going to prosecute a few people who actually assaulted some customers in the store. But for theft, from what I read, they're not going to be prosecuting for theft, only for assault. So we have flash mobs beginning all over the country. And then the other day, the Sogdologer, a guy named Al Gore, you know, he's the Fed of the Warm Earth Society, he came out and he called for a peaceful demonstration, an American Spring modeled after the Arab Spring. Now, that's kind of interesting. Think of all the revolutions you can think of. And in every revolution that I'm aware of, people were out in the streets with pitchforks and knives, swords and everything else. Just turmoil in the streets. Except one. The only one where the riots took place before the war began, that was in Western Massachusetts when they told the judges to resign. And when the judges resigned, they went back to peaceful. They didn't burn down buildings. They didn't assault people. They didn't steal things. But the only revolution I can think of that was peaceful in that respect and always had civil government was the United States of America. If we've got flash mobs and these factions, the Mexican faction, I don't mean Mexican Americans that want to assimilate, I mean the ones, the 13 million and those that support them. That's a faction. The African Americans are a faction. The Muslims are a faction, and the Muslims probably have access to resources like RPGs and things like that that they could get over here, bring across the Mexican or the Arizona or New Mexico or Texas border. If we have this Arab Spring and people out rioting in the street, let's go back to C3CM. They've identified who the leadership is in the Patriot community. They've also moved some people up in the hierarchies of those organizations. Now, if there's rioting in the streets come March, and I think March is the tentative date for this American Spring peaceful demonstration, which will not be. If you watched the G20 in Pittsburgh last year, peaceful demonstrations turn unpeaceful when the police start taking their riot gear and beating on people's heads. And then some people will strike back. People planted in the march can begin violence, break some windows, start some fires. It's very easy to take a large peaceful demonstration, if it's not well controlled, and move it into a violent confrontation rather than a nonviolent confrontation. So when that violent confrontation comes, FBI comes to Gary Hunt and say, hey, we understand you were responsible for that big mob that did all that damage in San Francisco. Well, I haven't been to San Francisco. Well, we have word that you were, so you're going to have to tell it to the judge. And so they arrest me, take me to jail 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. A year later, they take me to court. I don't think it would work with me because I think I know some tricks. But on an average, I go to jail and they hold me or I bail out. But I'm off the streets, and I'm under scrutiny. And if I bailed out, I signed an agreement saying I won't piss on the ground, I won't drink beer, and I won't touch my rifles, or I have to turn my rifles in. So they've taken out the leadership and put them under put them under a microscope. They're being watched all the time. Who knows? Maybe they'll give me an ankle bracelet. So they've taken out the leadership. Now, two things happen now. If there's none of their people ready to move up into roles in leadership, and there's no leadership in that organization is going to have pretty much fall apart and have to rebuild itself, or find those people go out and find another organization that's got some coherency and join it. Now, if that other organization that has some coherency has got a plant that's been planted in there and he's ascended to leadership or at least one of the important roles, like one of the Schaefer Cox's top eight people, then all of a sudden your leadership is the government. Now, I've got a PDF that was done by University of Chicago about the anti-war period in the 60s and 70s across the country. The Students for Democratic Society, SDS, some of the chapters were actually set up by the government. On those that weren't set up by then, they smoothed themselves into roles of influence in the leadership, and eventually took over leadership. So they were very effective in infiltrating these organizations, and it was 40, 50 years ago. Think how much they've mastered the art since then. So we have to talk factions. Now, is something going to happen? I have never predicted something going to happen before in my life, except my birthday's tomorrow or something like that. Or Christmas is on the 25th of December. That's the closest I've ever gotten to prophecy. But I see a lot of things coming together, the open borders and the government turning their backs and rationalizing to the people and the people believing it. I see a debt now that is going to exceed $100,000 to my great-grandchildren when they're born. It's a one-way trip, our economy right now, and the only alternative to it, there are two alternatives. One is to change the government back to the Constitution. On my blog, there's an article called An Economic Solution, which proposes one possible method of resolving the debt crisis. Or what we're going to do is find that we've got a new currency, a new Ponzi scheme, because that one ran out. Any Ponzi scheme eventually runs out. You know, if you all have to get on an airplane and pay $10 to get in, but you get $5 for each person that you bring onto the airplane, eventually you run out of people to pay their $10 to get on the airplane. And you stop getting your $5. The Federal Reserve System is exactly that. It's run to the end of its course. To survive, it has to have people borrow money so they can pay money back. All the money is borrowed in existence, and even more money has to be paid back. Now, if more money has to be paid back than is borrowed in existence, that forces borrowing more money. So recently, when the interest rates went down to 1.5%, that's because people weren't borrowing money. But they still wouldn't borrow money, so the federal government had to begin borrowing money to keep that Federal Reserve Ponzi scheme solvent. So it's met the end of its course. Everybody's jumped on the plane. The plane's about ready to crash. The alternative then is to switch currencies. Neat little trick. Let's go to electronic currency. It's not as visible. All you got to do is punch computer chips, but you still got debt problems with the rest of the world. But see, it's at its end. What they did last Tuesday in their vote is they extended for 3 more years the continual increase of debt. So that means they've got to move within those 3 years, because if you look at the outrage, even among Democrats right now, this is their last shot. They ain't going to pull us off again. So that says something's going to happen within 3 years. Well, Gore's calling for Arab Spring in 2012. Now, let's see, Obama's second term. We've got to talk about Obama's second term. Do you think he's got a chance? Anybody that stands up ought to be shot. He has no chance of a second term now. If he ever had one, it went with it, what he's done recently with the debt ceiling. So if Obama's the one that's going to be the leader into this big drastic change in the nature of the United States of America and in incorporation into a one-world community, he's got to do it before November of next year. Well, March of next year comes well before November of next year. We've got Patriots being compromised. I've got a friend who says that he and a bunch of his buddies were put in Suburbans, taken for a drive, questioned in a trailer, and then returned home. I don't have anything to back that up. I've known the guy for 3 or 4 years on conversations in mail correspondence as well as online correspondence. I've never met him face to face. We've talked on the phone many times. I don't know if it's true or not. But if we find out that they're starting to bring a little pressure upon the Patriot community by pushing people into doing things they wouldn't have otherwise done, like gathering names in underground railroads or gathering more information, asking more questions for you to join a website, various things like that. All these things are beginning to come together, and they frame out time. Now, that time it cannot be yesterday, so beginning today, and at latest November of 2012, but given that about halfway to November 2012, we've got a call for an American Spring, if that thing evolves and it starts getting organized, I think that we can expect that the day that happens, they will be rounding up Patriots. They'll do it at 8 o'clock in the morning in California, 9 o'clock in Mountain Time, 10 o'clock Central Time, 11 o'clock Eastern Time. They'll just swoop down and take out the leadership. And if you don't have a good plan in place, you'll be fumbling around trying to figure out what to do next. If you've got a bad guy in your group, he may ascend to the leadership. But you know, that we have a schedule now, and that is March of 2012, when we can expect that the shit hits the fan. Now, it's not going to be Lexington and Concord. It's going to be a lot more subtle than that. Under any guise, they will be arresting people that they can. The public attention will be on what's happening when they're going into these stores and burning down buildings and these riots in the street and pitchforks, just like in all the other revolutions. And the end result of all those other revolutions is he who holds the power becomes the law afterwards. None of them went back to their original form of government after that revolution. We went back closer to the English Constitution than we were under the English Constitution and the charters under British rule. All the others go away from the principles of government that they had beforehand, and that's what American Spring just may do to us. Okay, I'm done spouting or something. What, Randy?
You know, guys, I wanted to comment on a couple of points you had brought up. You know, first was the fact what you had talked about in the 60s with the infiltration and the actual creation of some of these groups and organizations that were rioting in the streets. You know, some of the people that I've often spoken about who were the creators, the blueprint makers, if you will, for this whole world governmental system, like Bertrand Russell. You know, Bertrand Russell was an English lord who basically put forth the entire educational and psychological curriculum for our children in throughout the world today, which was implemented by UNESCO and Julian Huxley. Now, he came here in the U.S. in the 60s as an old geezer. And he created a little group called the Council of 100. And he would take these radical socialist youth, and they would mob airports, kick over, you know, tear up fences, kick down the fences, mob the airports, attack people throughout the cities, things like this. You know, the DOJ back in 54 had openly stated, never again will we allow a grassroots organization to rise up that has not either been infiltrated or created by us. You know, so a lot of these things that we talk about, we can see going on today with, you brought up an excellent case in point, Schaefer Cox. You know, if we look at one, you know, if we look at who one of the informants for Schaefer Cox was, it was one of his command staff who was sent in there specifically to infiltrate and to bring him down. You know, we see this going on daily. Huttery had an FBI infiltrator in there. All these groups and organizations, you know, the DOJ openly claims that 1 in 6 patriots are actually agents. That does not include all of the
informers
they have and all of the snitches they have. It doesn't even include them. But 1 in 6 patriots is actually an agent of some form or another, whether it's a local police, a federal agent, whatever it is.
Now,
you know, these are the problems that we face today.
That brings up an interesting point, too. Is the militia itself qualified to judge those that are in it? We're buddy-buddy, and you're an officer in this militia and all that. Wouldn't a civilian body, the Committee of Safety, be in a better position, a little greater distance to, say, vet the people in the militia to make sure that we're clean?
I believe so. I mean, that would be one of the roles that they would have to take on, I believe. You know, checks and balances, if you will. I know that, like in OHMM, you know, people are vetted. I know other militias vet their people. You know, but it's, I cannot disagree with having multiple sets of eyes doing the same thing, a checks and balances, if you will. Some, you know, we might not miss something. And if there's a subcommittee specifically tasked with doing that, you know, I think we would be much better off, you know, getting rid of those who do not belong, if you will. Getting rid of those whose only goal and agenda is to cause disruption within the organization and the unit itself, within the movement of the cause. You know, I'm sure if Schaefer Cox had done a little bit better job vetting his people, he might have realized that this guy who climbed the ranks, you know, just incredibly fast and was more than always willing to step up to the plate and always there and always willing to help out. He might have been caught. Schaefer might not be in jail. Who knows? I don't know. But I do know that it was because of an infiltrator that Schaefer got taken down.
See, those,
you know, good, bad, or indifferent what he did.
That goes back to the 90s, too. The Viper Militia in Phoenix, the West Virginia Militia, and it goes back to the 60s, the anti-war movement, the Gainesville 7. You know, this has been going on. I've got a 1972 Internal Revenue Service memo out of Los Angeles where they talked about in-depth infiltration of the Patriot community. When we started the Committee of Safety in Orlando, Florida, this guy that, real nice, you know, he would, so that Eileen had the car, he would come and pick me up for the meetings. And when the Florida Common Law Court went on trial, this real nice guy was an FBI IRS undercover agent. I didn't even know they had undercover agents in the IRS until then. But he had infiltrated our group. He was real nice, liked by everybody, very friendly, and he was a government informant and testified against these people later on. So the possibility that somebody within your group, and I don't want everybody to get suspicious, go on the way you're going, but we need to start thinking about the consequences of not everybody, or of everybody being evaluated by an independent body that you have trust in. Now, if you have a Committee of Safety, it's always possible that it could be infiltrated as well. But if the Committees of Safety get together and come up with a means, you know, somebody finds access to the NCIC computers, for example, and can run names of people and get responses, that you have a lot better possibility of vetting people and finding out if somebody has a questionable background and should be very limited in their access until they've proven themselves. I mean, there was an old test in the 60s, you know. You knew it wasn't a government agent. See, back then it was true. Now it's not. You knew it wasn't a government agent if he smoked a joint with you. Because if he smoked a joint and you testified it, he broke the law too. They've changed the law since then. Now he can smoke a joint with you and still bust you. But that was, if you could get somebody to smoke a joint with you, you could pretty much rest assured. But they've changed the laws to allow their infiltration to lie, cheat, and steal. But, you know, we got to start thinking that way, because quite honestly, I think that we are coming to the time that the shit will hit the fan, and it will not be martial law, declaration of martial law. It'll just be little civil or criminal arrests here and there all over the country of important people. It'll be very subtle. It will go almost unnoticed until everybody says, hey, our CO got arrested. And then the word will finally catch up through the internet or through some means of communication, and we'll find out that all these leaders have just been arrested, and they're gone. It'll be very subtle. It'll be a couple days before the full awareness of what has happened occurs to us. Oh, that leaves, what's the alternative to that? Is there any way to resist that? I don't know. You know, in the military, they always say the best defense is good offense. And if you read history and battles, quite often an undermanned fort, South Carolina, up in French and Indian Wars and the Revolution, up in the New York regions, the wilderness regions, sometimes it was to your advantage to leave the security of the fort, do the unexpected, and attack the enemy while they were preparing to attack you. If you take them in an unexpected manner and disrupt them, you create a psychological damage on them too. We just got our asses kicked by those puny little mother. There are a lot of advantages sometimes to having the initiative, because you know who, what, where, and when, and that's important. Now, if we leave to them the initiative, what, where, when, then they're going to decide what, where, when. But if we take the initiative, now, what do I mean by the initiative? Randy, I think we've talked about the plan before a couple hundred times. The plan has parts one and two, and that is the beginning of the initiative. Part three becomes more of an organized initiative and actually securing your community. But if we want to take the initiative and not be subject to their schedule, we have 7 months to do so, 6 months to do so. If we take the initiative in the next 6 months, we can put a stick in the spokes of their plans. Now, people say, well, they'll declare martial law. Well, let's wait until April and see if we get by scot-free. And if not, it's too late. And if we did get by, I'll be surprised. But it's all a matter of faith. And that faith is not in that they're going to declare martial law or some stupid concept that would piss off everybody in this country. They're not going to do that. They're not that dumb. Think about it. They're going to do something that kind of mixes into the crowd and gets lost. Good example. We know that when they went in, now, I'm not debating whether bin Laden died 7 years ago because some newspaper reported it, or if he died a few months ago because he was shot by the SEAL team. What it amounts to is we believed, because the government told us over and over and over again, that they tried to take bin Laden alive, but his actions, even though he didn't have a rifle in his hand, his actions were such that we had to shoot to protect our lives. Two articles came out this week making it quite clear that the game plan was to go in and kill bin Laden. They did not want to bring any living bodies back. So that's, I wrote an article, Prima Facie Story, that goes back to Bosnia years ago in the deception of government, and they get the first story out, and most people accept that. Yellowcake's another good example in Iraq, but in this case, we were given this warm and fuzzy. We tried to take him alive, but just circumstances and, you know, the anxiety and the darkness and everything, we just had to shoot him. This is the story that we got in the press, and now we have a very in-depth analysis of the entire operation in one article, and a naval officer coming out and saying the same thing, that the objective from the get-go was to kill bin Laden, and the code word when he was definitely dead was Geronimo, and that code word was given while they were in the compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. So the government is very deceptive, and they're warm and fuzzy. And when they come to take out the Patriots, they'll be as warm and fuzzy. They'll make it sound like something else. We just did the most extensive drug bust in the history of the United States. We did it from the West Coast to the East Coast, all over the country, and we've got 712 people that we've taken into custody, and we're looking for another 330. Most of them might not even do drugs. They might just wave a flag that says, you have tread on me, or don't tread on me. So do we have any questions from the audience? And I, you know, I had one Skype guy that wanted to come in, and I chatted him. Jim, if you're out there, do you still want to come on?
John Glove wants to come on. Let me find him. You haven't gotten a contact from him.
No, I just asked him, and I haven't heard back. I don't know if the Scotsman's out there. Michael, did you want to come on? Anybody in the chat room got any questions?
Well, you know, I have a question for you, just to clarify something. You know, when we were talking earlier about who we the people are, you know, the end basis of what I got out of that entire statement of who you were saying was we the people was somebody who had, you know, basically a naturalized citizen or a natural born citizen, whatever, that was supportive of our country, supportive of our governmental system, and supportive of our way of life. And those who were looking to change that, overthrow it, or had ulterior motives for being here were not we the people ever. And are not to be construed as we the people. Am I correct there?
Well, they may have been we the people and then changed their sympathies to something other than the principal faction. And you said natural born citizen. No, that's not a factor. Natural born citizen is a requirement for a president only. Citizen of the United States is a requisite of so many years, a requisite for the House of Representatives and the Senate. Which brings the question that whether Obama could ever be a natural-born citizen in that sense. It gets rather involved, but can he be a natural-born citizen? A natural-born citizen is one that was, with the exception of the first period of time when nobody was born in this country that was old enough to serve in federal offices, whether he could be a natural-born citizen by virtue of what was written back then, which has to be the intent, regardless of what they write later on, and that would be of an American mother, an American father, and born in America or on American soil, which would include, as I see it, military installations, embassies, things like that. I may be wrong, but I think that that standard was applied to John McCain, who was born out of the country. And I'm not sure he was born on a military installation, but he was definitely the exclusion of jurisdiction was included ambassadors and people like that. So similarly, in a foreign country, they don't have jurisdiction over our ambassadors. It's the privilege that all countries offer to other people. So...
Well, I mentioned the natural-born citizen because I said naturalized or natural-born, either one. You know, but you had to be a citizen, and then from there you also had to not attempt to basically overthrow our government and change it from a republic form of government to something else. Because at that point, you know, in my opinion, maybe I'm wrong here in my understanding of what you were saying, but if your attempt was to overthrow the republic or to change the republic and change it in any way to something else, well, you were no longer considered part of we the people.
Well, that gets into a touchy issue. In terms of faction, there's no doubt that the they're not a part of the faction if they've abandoned this country. You know, going with the enemy has occurred all through history. North, even the Civil War and the Revolution. Look at Benedict Arnold. You know, I'm not one to judge, but the way I see it is you can be one of we the people, but if you abandon that principal faction, even though you're still a citizen of the United States or a United States citizen or a citizen of your state, that you are not a part of the faction that wants the Constitution to be the supreme law of the land.
You know, I think that's something that we need to get back to is getting rid of, like we had mentioned earlier, we were talking about earlier, is getting rid of those factions that divide us and all of us coming back under that one banner, we the people, for our constitutional government that will stand in defense of it and will stand in defense of our own liberties and our own freedoms. As defined by that Declaration of Independence. You know, that was truly our founding document that said what we would not endure by government and what we would accept by government. And the fact that we, the people, had the right to change government when government ever became destructive to its own, to those ends.
Well, that's the whole premise behind the article I wrote, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. But, you know, I can't really say what I've never researched what the lawful elements are. I remember when I was a kid, one of the movies we saw in school was The Man Without a Country, where he had his citizenship removed and he was relegated to living the rest of his life on a ship. I really don't know how that works, and I can't, you know, I can only say what appears to be true to me, and I can't say what is true. I will say that in the plan, it goes to the point of saying people can have their citizenship revoked by denying their allegiance to the Constitution, that you have to have a common heritage and a common culture and a goal. If nothing else, they have to be relegated to a point that they cannot affect the outcome of the country. But see, that's something that wasn't made clear back then, and I don't think it was a big problem. And I think it's one of those things that we need to address when we begin wresting power from those rebels in Washington who have taken over our government. You know, it requires some serious thought on how do we deal with people that do abandon that concept. And I can't say that I can find a law that says that they are not we the people, but I know that they are not supporting the principal faction.
You know, that's, you know, we really need to get back to it. And if, you know, if anybody, you know, Gary and I worked on a document. Gary just posted a link for it, You Have Tread on Me. You can also find it at the top of the website at youhavetreadonme.com, a little thing called the petition. You know, I would read that. You know, I would definitely read that and understand it.
I would print out 3 copies and send them to 2 senators and a representative, too. If you want to make your statement, something that was discussed last night on your show, I think this is a more appropriate way than perhaps trying to get in the grand jury. Why not both? You know, for a few $15, according to his price, $5 and what, 47 cents more, you can send out 3 petitions to House Senator or Representative and 2 senators in your state. But it's based on the Olive Branch petition saying, look, if you represent us, get back to in adherence to the Constitution, and this is what we demand that you do. Otherwise, you no longer represent us. And that's the form that over 90 declarations of independence took before Thomas Jefferson put pen to paper on late June 1776. That all over the country, committees of safety, Worcester, Massachusetts in 1774, discharged British government and set up their own government. They declared independence from Britain, and they did it because of violation of the Charter. The Olive Branch Petition was the last chance, and it was, understand, the Olive Branch Petition, for those that penned it, most of them realized that the only reason we're doing this is these people that think that there's a peaceful reconciliation need to find out that there is not a peaceful reconciliation. So they all signed it and sent it to England, and it sat there and floated.
Well, you know, I'd like to read something that Equalizer had posted in the chat room, if you don't mind.
Go.
He said, "Don't Tread on Me is just a rattle, unless enforced, backing, you know, or backed up, or backing up that warning, in which none of us have done, it is nothing more than a hollow threat." You know, and I agree with that. You know, we can chant all the slogans that we want and all the mottos that we want, but unless we enact upon them and not just prattle them off like some indoctrinated socialist prattling off the Communist Manifesto, they're really just empty words. They require action. You know, our founding fathers took action with that Olive Branch Petition. That was serious action. I mean, that was treason. the Declaration of Independence was considered treason. That was action. They took action for their freedom because they refused to be less than men. And I don't know what about you guys, but I know that right now when they take 60% of your paycheck through one of the 200 plus differing taxes, and they basically make you endure a strip search to get on a plane, and they come and they take your children at will because somebody in CPS, not a grand jury or some other lawful organization, has deemed you an unfit parent, but because some individual in some bureaucracy says you're unfit, they come and they steal your children, at which they get paid $16,000 for after they sell it off to some other family. You know, our founding fathers endured so much less than we endure today, and they put a stop to it. Yet we prattle these slogans, these mantras, and where is our action? Where is our action backing it up? I say we take that action, read that document, fill it out, sign your name to it.
Back to what Equalizer said, I see now I misunderstood the concept, context of what he said. I thought he was saying none of us have, made our case. Now, right after I wrote the petition, I sent my three copies in, and nobody wrote. I didn't even get one of these form letters saying, "Oh, we are considering what you have written, or our policy is this or policy." I didn't get a letter back from the congressman that I sent it to. So, at that point, I joined my grandchildren in absence of representation in this Congress. So I am in that state of nature that Thomas Jefferson wrote about. John Locke wrote about it initially. As far as none of us have done it yet, if I get the context right now, yes, some have. Tim McVeigh was one. And I know a lot of you will disagree with me, but Tim McVeigh did do something. Now, part one and part two of the plan is an open door. It's an invitation. It's an authority, because it's explained in there that your rights, you read the petition, you see what your rights are, you see you're not represented, is the authority under the Declaration of Independence for us to begin acting in the best interest of our country. And to say that they've got to shoot first, that's bullshit. That kills you. Anybody that thinks that you go into something as important as restoring constitutional government in this country, that they've got to shoot first, that's bullshit, because we support our military going and shooting first all over the world. Why can't we support us shooting first? It's time for us to start doing something so that some of us have done it. That is, some do it, and we get behind them, at least not in words, if not deeds, and don't condemn them for doing it, then others will follow suit and more will do it. And then we have more to get to behind. Now, another interesting thing, if you've been watching the news lately, we didn't have a president assassinated, but the news is almost all about the debt crisis. It seems that the only people that believe it was the right thing to do are the Washington pundits and Congress. The rest of the world, most of the stock markets, everything says that was stupid. Now, we've got Democrats beginning to back away from Obama because of this. They're trying to excuse what happened and all that. But even on some of the Tea Party sites, I've seen people beginning to acknowledge that, yes, we have gone beyond hope. And maybe it is time to start thinking about the alternative. I know there's somebody listening to the show tonight that I talked to earlier today, if he's still listening, that is beginning to shift horses. You know, he's the one, we've got to try all these peaceful solutions. Well, yes, we do. I guess my experience, my 30 years in the Patriot community, or involvement at a distance, and then 20 years very active, has convinced me that we have tried every option. I wrote the three boxes about that the legislative process has been taken away from us because they have controlled the elections, and to think that we can wrest their control of the elections back to our control is futile. I've published articles about what's happened to the judicial system, and they've taken that. And, you know, I got to say what Walt Fitzpatrick did in Tennessee, I applaud, because he demonstrated one of the problems. But there's a time when you realize you're pissing in the wind by trying to get something done that won't get done. And I don't know that, hey, if you want to try, try. But I think that you're going to run into the same obstacle that the grand juries did back in the 90s. And that was a brick wall. You get nowhere. In fact, the Florida Common Law Court grand jury, those guys went to prison for 15 years. So, when you push far enough, they're going to come and step on your toes.
I agreed with him to a point. You know, we do need to continue to attempt all peaceful means. Yet at the same time, I believe that we must always anticipate having to, you know, anticipate plan A, the peaceful resolve, and then plan B, the as peaceful as they will allow restoration of our constitutional government. You know, when you play chess, you don't play chess one move at a time. You're playing chess 10, 15 moves ahead of your game. And that plan is constantly changing based upon the next person, upon your opponent's next move. But you're constantly thinking 10, 15 moves ahead if you're any good. Sometimes even more if you're damn good. You know, but
let's just stop at,
you know,
10
people
step.
That constantly
part
think
one
about
the part
peaceful
10.
Resolve, they never think of they never seem to get past that peaceful resolve and never start to look at, well, what if it doesn't work?
That's true. And the Declaration of Independence and the Olive Branch Petition both came after hostilities began.
Well, we got a question here. Fox actually put in a question for you. I don't know if you're looking at the chat room, but he says, have we tried governing ourselves, Gary? Have we tried implementing committees of safety and phasing out the Fed's authority?
Well, the concept of committee of safety apparently was pretty fresh in the minds of the people back 230 years ago, because they had existed in a lot of areas of the country because the government could not put forces out there to protect them from Indian attack, for example. So they had to exist, and in some of the smaller communities, they might have taken the form of a town meeting or anything, but they were in their thoughts. Now, the new form of government came in was one that was based upon those concepts, but over time it's been taken away from us. And the best example of that is a place called Quartzsite, Arizona, right now. The concept of the people, it used to be at a town meeting, the majority did rule. But now if they have a public hearing and there's 300 people against an ordinance and three people for it, being relatives of those on the commission will still vote to approve it. That's not representative government. Oh, but they know more than we do. Well, wait a minute. No, it's supposed to be common people running this government. If you know more than us, you're keeping secrets from us. What are the secrets you're keeping? Well, we have to keep those secret because of our sources or that. They always have a reason why they can't tell us why. But,
you know, that was something that Alexander Hamilton believed. He believed that, you know, the common man was just too stupid, too ignorant to lead this country, so they needed their betters to do the thinking for them. You know, he was very much the aristocrat, and, you know, I really didn't like him for that very reason. You know, he was the antithesis of what we were trying to found in this country. Getting away from the aristocrat, getting away from the bourgeois, getting away from those who thought they were better than we, the people. And we, the people, actually being in charge for once in our lives, for once in history.
Yeah, here's some numbers for you. 1% of the people in this country are millionaires or above. 44% of Congress is millionaires or above. Is that representative government? Anyway, I want to go back to Fox's question. Now, we'll go on with this. Committees of safety are being implemented. There are a few starting now, but if you read the plan, why are people not starting? Let me back up a little. In 1830s, Texas looked back 60 years prior to that and said, we got a problem with Mexico. So they formed committees of safety. The committees of safety, and this is even on Wikipedia, sent their delegates to some town, I forgot which one. They elected Austin the leader and brought their militias in. They followed the concept of the founders. But in that period of time, we've lost touch with that, so it's hard for people. We've got Neighborhood Watch, they'll take care of us. We've got FEMA, they'll take care of us. Bullshit. Wait for FEMA to take care of you after a hurricane or a flood. But So the plan, when it was written, talks about a different playing field. We're in a different playing field. We don't have the knowledge from the founders. We have the belief that was taught us in government schools that the government will take care of everything. So it's a slow process in getting the recognition of the right that we have inherently to have committees of safety. So the plan starts talking about committees of safety in parts one and two, but they really don't come into a functional entity until part three, because we've got to, two things have to happen. One, we got to recognize the power of the Committee of Safety, our authority, as there was in Worcester, Massachusetts, to say we are going to govern ourselves. Screw this elected government in this city or county or town. We are going to govern ourselves. Two is for people to realize that they've got that things are happening. I don't want to use shit hits the fan because that everybody looks for Lexington Concord on that. I've explained what I think shit hits the fan is going to be, but I think that we need to be ahead of shit hits the fan, just like they were in Western Massachusetts over a year before Lexington and Concord they began acting. So the plan is written to start a process. Now, if you go to, let me see if I can find the link. If you go to my outpost of, here's the link. There's a movie here called April Morning. Okay, that link is to take you to the video library, and there's a movie there called April Morning. If you watch that, or if you read Lucy Hosmer's diary, which is on my blog, you'll see that people didn't really expect that we were going to fight the British. Some did, some were anxious to, some weren't. You'll find one guy on there that dies an American, so he's happy to die an American. It was April 19, 1775. Others that died before then that thought that they would never fight the British but died fighting the British. But until that point in time of the reality of the situation hits you, you're just a computer warrior. What can I say? You're talking. You might be preparing and all that. But there's a point in time where reality strikes home. Now, to initiate that point in time, these people in Western Massachusetts said, we're going to kick out the judges. We're going to set up our own government. And this is a year before Lexington and Concord. So some people are ahead of the curve, and others are way behind. Virginia was following, especially because of people like Patrick Henry and George Washington, were following along saying, you know, something's seriously wrong, we got to do something. But nobody was willing to do anything except the people in Western Massachusetts and some in South Carolina, where they had done some similar things, not as on as great a magnitude as happened in Western Massachusetts. But those that recognize the reality and begin acting will force the recognition of that reality on the others. It's easy to say now we'll do this, but I'm going to keep voting anyway, or I'm going to do this and I'm going to file with the grand jury, or I'm going to do this. But you're resting their hope on the wrong cause. If you rest your hope on the plan, but then until you're ready to really get out your guns and take over your community, you want to do those petitions, but as long as your goal now is, hey, my goal is I'm going to get my country back no matter what it takes. And while I'm preparing to do that, I'll do this. Now, when reality hits, then you're prepared to proceed. And you'll start proceeding. But if you put your eggs in the other basket, the petition or the grand jury or getting Ron Paul elected, and he'll be overridden by the Congress every time he turns around, or the any of these other divide-and-conquer aspects, your eggs are in the wrong basket. You're not prepared. You just hope. You're hoping against hope, that the elusive phantom of hope is what Patrick Henry called it. You're following that elusive phantom of hope without real recognition of the reality of the severity of the problem and the fact that those elusive phantoms of hope are nothing more than elusive phantoms of hope. We've got to be prepared. We've got to begin moving in the direction of restoring constitutional government to this country for the sake of ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, our posterity, and those that might come from Europe afterwards, because the United States can become a symbol to the world again. It has lost that meaning. Right now, it's a handout to the world. People are coming here because of what's offered, not what they can achieve here, but what they can get for free. And we've got to go back to them.
You know, I keep thinking about a sign. You know, to back up what you said, I keep thinking about the sign that I saw during a protest from a La Raza protest down in California or Arizona or somewhere. And I'm sure everybody around the internet has seen it. It's been passed around to millions and millions, you know, everybody out there. You know, but it said, give us free money, free homes, free food, free everything, you know, free medical, or we'll continue to kill more cops.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is what they want. This is what they expect here. This is what they envision the American dream as, the free handout.
And
it was never
good.
The free handout. It was the ability, you know, the American dream was the dream that you could pursue your own happiness, your own livelihood, your own property, that you could pursue your own freedom.
Now, what you just
that you were never guaranteed to get that happiness. You were never guaranteed to make your fortune, but at least you were guaranteed the right to go after it.
What you just said, Randy, though, that's what I expect will happen in March of 2012, that those people will be rioting in the streets, which didn't happen in our revolution. The only riot that I'm aware of is the Boston Massacre. For the most part, the rest of it then was an organized effort to expel the government and replace it with one that was more along the lines of what the people expected the British Constitution to assure, and then subsequently went to the Articles of Confederation Constitution. But if we have the rioting in the streets, you will find those same people shooting cops. And then it turns violent, and it won't be a peaceful one. And, you know, Gore will have gotten his wish. He said peaceful revolution, but he meant get the people in the streets because he knows damn well it won't be peaceful, especially if you have those factions intent on making sure their ideals are propagated against the wishes of those of us that are part of the principal faction.
So, well, you know, I was talking to an acquaintance of mine, and she said that, you know, she kind of likes some of the socialist ideas. You know, she likes the concept of freedom and everything else, but she does feel that America needs some of those socialist ideas as well. And I said, you know, Russia kind of started off that way, as did Nazi Germany, as did, you know, Mussolini's Italy, Spain, Cuba, all these countries, you know, they all started off with these ideas of the people's revolution. You know, and they always talked about the peaceful revolution, yet once it got into place, it was never peaceful by any means. It was always bloody. And whether that blood starts at the beginning or it ends up at the end, getting rid of all those who don't agree with it, it has always ended up bloodied. And that's how socialism starts. Marx even said that we encroach upon, we start off small, we get our foothold in the door, and then slowly we begin to infect everything else around us and we take over from there. Until people cannot ever remember anything else ever being there but socialism.
And that's where we're going, unless we take the initiative and keep the time, who, what, and where, out of the hands of the rebels in Washington and in the hands of the principal faction. And, I've been trying to think of a good name for principal faction. It is We the People, but it also includes those who are not of We the People, but choose to assimilate. So if anybody's got any suggestions for what I can use when I'm writing to describe that principal faction rather than principal faction, I'd appreciate it. But understand the concept that principal faction has to be above all other factions if we are to prevail.
Well, listen, we are down to our last minute, so if you want to say anything in closing, you know, we'll go over. I went over last night, so it's not a big deal. It's my stream. I can go over if I want. So, do you have any closing remarks or closing ideas, closing suggestions?
No, I think I pretty much laid them all out. I think that we need to understand that if we don't take the initiative, they will. In fact, they have the initiative now. We need to take it from them. So
I know my suggestion to this is to everybody, you know, I would go back and read the plan. You can find it on Gary's website, outpost-of-freedom.com. There's a big link there for the blog. Go to the blog, do a search for the plan for the restoration of constitutional government. Now, that plan was based upon our founding fathers' plan. It's just been modernized, you know, it's just been adapted for a modern theater. But it basically goes through the steps that the founding fathers went through, or those in the, you know, or those colonists who were involved in that original revolution. Not necessarily the, you know, the revolution meaning the war itself, because the revolution happened long before the war ever broke out. The revolution was in the hearts and the minds of the people. It was a change in their mentality, in their ideology, in their belief system. It was a change from thinking that the king rules us and we are the king's servants and slaves to we are free men and we, and there will be no king, king above us except for our creator. Now go back and read that, and wherever you fit in, you fit in. I mean, you know, there, like we mentioned, like Gary had mentioned before, you know, there were those that were in the militia that stayed the course. They did what was constitutional, you know, they did what was lawful and what was right. They defended their homes. There was the Sons of Liberty who engaged upon another path. There was groups that did many different things. There were those who were more civically minded who went, who joined, who formed the committees of safety. And who were the local government. Find your role. Do something. And by all means, please, download that pamphlet. You can get it off the website here, U of Tredemy, or you can get it from, oh, I'm sorry, not the pamphlet, the petition. You can get the U of Tredemy petition here off the website. You can get it from Gary's website, outpost-of-freedom.com. Download it, read it, understand it, and then sign it and send it in to your two senators and your congressmen. After that, feel more than free to send it to your governor and as many state legislatures as you want as well. But it must be a physical copy. No email. Don't email it in. Those just get deleted. No mass signatures on one sheet. One signature, one individual per petition.
Let that way, 10,000 people is 10,000 sheets of paper, not 20 sheets of paper.
Exactly. 20,000 petitions for 20,000 people instead of one petition for 20,000. That doesn't take up any space. It takes up no labor on their end to collect these all. It's easy to forget about a single petition with 20,000 names attached to it. You can just easily throw that in the garbage. But let this be your olive branch petition. Stand behind it. Stand up and say, I am done. You will obey.
And lead,
this
read
is our
the,
last straw.
Read the last paragraph of the petition very carefully and understand that you are telling them that you either comply or you no longer represent us. Now, if you don't hear back from them in a reasonable amount of time, and I'd say a reasonable amount of time with their automated systems is 10 days, and they don't respond directly to what you've sent to them or don't respond at all, that you can consider that you are in a state of nature as the Founding Fathers did, the people in Western Massachusetts and subsequently most of the people in this country. I would also suggestions. Those of you who have just listened tonight, I've kind of touched the surface, but the series I wrote, five-part series, are all relatively short. We the People, But Who Are We? There's the link to it, part one, and it will have links to part two, three, four, and five. I would suggest you read that so that you understand the point that's being made. Now, there's another series coming out dealing with factions, which I've touched upon tonight, but I'm going to go in greater depth on what factions are and how we need to resolve it. But we have to begin looking that those factions are destructive. They're just emotional factions. They're religious or belief factions. The principal faction has to be identified and adhered to regardless of the others. And you'll have to, as the Maryland Resolve said in 1774, put aside all differences and bury in oblivion our disagreements. If we are going to achieve our goal, we have to put those aside and realize that if they are willing to stand with their back against the principal element and defend it with you, that they have as much right to stand beside you, even if you request a distance from them. They have as much right to stand behind you and cannot be excluded from participation in restoring constitutional government to this country.
I agree. Time to put aside our differences and our petty gripes. And, you know, an example of that, putting aside our differences and our petty gripes, tonight Freebird came in, and I know many of you Maybe not all of you know that. Freebird and I and Frankie Sheen split ways many, 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 many months ago. And which is a sad thing, because in the end, we're all trying to do, trying to achieve the same goal. Some of us understand what that goal is better. Some of us understand the Constitution better than others. But in the end, I hope that we are all trying to achieve the same goal, a return to our constitutional government. You know, Freebird and I, Gary tried to get Freebird and I together before to dissolve this squabble, this disagreement, if you will, and it didn't work. Tonight, Freebird came on the air, came on the chat room tonight, and he apologized for what he said, what had happened. And I accepted his apology and said there was nothing to forgive. We're the, you know, same cause, same purpose, same goal, same team. Fox keeps telling me that. Same team, same team. We need that mentality again, the same team. Divide, you know, division causes nothing but loss. As long as we stay divided. Well, what was the saying? You know, united we stand, divided we hang. You know, we will either stand, together or we will hang together. That's it. That's the bottom line.
We will hang separately.
So we will hang separately, or we will either stand together or we will hang separately. You choose what your goal is. I know that I will stand with those that are around me. And if we hang, if we are to hang, then we will hang together. I doubt they'll get us to a gallows, though. I doubt they'll get us anywhere, but they can come try. And if they leave us alone and they restore our Constitution and our freedom and our constitutional government, then they have nothing to worry about from us. We'll be more than happy to live our lives peacefully.
Is that that elusive phantom of hope?
What's that?
Is that that elusive phantom of hope?
You know what? It's not hope, man. It's just a belief that we will. It's not a hope. I know this in my heart. You know, we had somebody on the show the other day who was rather pessimistic about our chances and everything. You know, I don't have that pessimism in my heart. Either way it goes, I will die a free man, whether it's in an old man's bed or it's on my feet in my boots with my, you know, with my rifle screaming my defiance against tyranny. It makes no difference to me, but I will die a free man. That's all there is to it.
Some of you may have received emails from me and seen my new signature. I've had it for a couple months now. The first four words came from Nord Davis. He used that on almost everything he wrote. It says, "An American without apology." Then it continues, "And one who can think of no other time and place in history that I would rather be alive." Take heart in the fact that you have been born into a time when we can restore what those were willing to give their lives for 230 years ago. Step into that realm that you are a part of history more than you ever expected before in your life, and that you have the opportunity now to become a part of history more than you ever thought before by participating from this point forward on restoration of constitutional government in this country.
You know, I used to read a lot of books about history. You know, our revolution, the beginning, you know, the beginning of concepts of natural law, or the restoration of the revitalization of the concepts of natural law in France and in England. I used to read about Cicero, where Cicero began speaking about natural law just before Julius Caesar took control of Rome. And I used to think, my God, how I wish I could live in those times. Little did I know that I would grow up to live in such a time. And you know what? I can't be happier for it. My wish came true. I got my wish. I live in such a time. Now the only thing that needs to be determined is how I will live during this time. Will I succumb to tyranny? Or will I stand for my freedom at all costs, no matter what? And will I be willing to do whatever it takes to maintain and keep it? I ask you all to decide that tonight for yourselves, to think on this. While you're filling out that petition and sending it in, let this be your olive branch and determine once and for all, I've had enough. And then decide what your plans are, where you fit into your role in this whole thing, and then act upon it. like Equalizer said, you know, these are just words. This don't tread on me, this you have tread on me, this Molon Levay. All of these are just slogans until we decide to act upon them. When will you begin to act? When will we people decide to stand united under one banner instead of being divided amongst ourselves? You know, we could talk and talk and talk all day long, but without action, it just leads to nothing more than debate. And there was a time to debate, yes. There was a time to discuss, yes. But then action must come as well. And what action you take is up to you. Some will form committees, some will join militia, some will do their own thing. But work towards that common goal and work for that common goal of being under one banner with we the people. And if not, well, then know what side of the fence you stand on. And realize the mistake you made in standing on that side of the fence. So with that being said, everybody, again, like I said, like I mentioned earlier on the show, starting tomorrow, we're going to have our server switched over. It's already ready to go. We just got to get our domain name pointed at it. Thank you again, Lieutenant Parker. You're a lifesaver here. I appreciate it so much. Also, I want to thank Gary. You know, I'm on a laptop here. Thank you, Cross, for, you know, the loaner and everything, but this laptop is kind of old and it's starting to have hardware problems now. And Gary has been so kind. He's boxed up a CPU for me now, and he's shipping it out tomorrow for me. So thank you, Gary, as well. You know, I've got some great listeners here, and I've got a bunch of great people around me that have always been willing to step forward and help out and to do their part. Smiter did a long time ago. Dave did. Dave put in hours and hours and hours. It went beyond, above and beyond the call of duty for this broadcast and these ideas that we present here. So, you know, look to what you can do as well in your community, in your town, your county, your state. Step forward and do the right thing. We'll begin to get the site updated again, get all of our old broadcasts up. We're going to start adding a bunch of new things to this site. We'll start doing that on Monday, so keep an eye out for that. And until then, next week, next Saturday, be safe and be free and do something. Take care. Bye-bye. Disconnect me.
Andy.
Yeah, we're still live, but so go ahead.
No, shut it off.
I'm trying to. The thing shut down on me.
Need to get you a decent computer.
Yeah, I know.
When you got to use the smoke signals to communicate.
Hang on, let me drop this call real quick so it ends on us, okay?
Okay.